ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः चैतन्यं सर्वगं सर्वं सर्वभूतगुहाशयं यत् सर्वविषयातीतं तस्मै सर्वविदे नमः. Good, welcome back. We continue our study of Upadesha Sahasri. Welcome also to all of the many students watching online. By the way, I enjoy reading your comments on the videos. I'm sorry I'm not able to respond to the comments or answer questions, but I do read every comment. And we've received more questions by email, and I'm afraid there are more questions than we can answer. So if I fail to respond to your question, I'm sorry. Two questions for today relating to our class. You said that in deep sleep one is fully conscious, but if that's the case, then why am I not aware of sounds around me, like my breath and heartbeat? And the questioner goes on, and from the question, from what follows, I came to understand that in deep meditation, this questioner finds the absence of thoughts. He says, I observe the absence of thoughts in deep sleep, in deep meditation. I make, you know, the mind becomes thought-free. You know that verbal chatter? Talk. Interesting how that talk goes on and on and on and on. That verbal chatter eventually comes to an end, so you observe that silence in the mind. But this questioner says he continues to observe sensations in the body in deep meditation. So the breathing of the body, the beating of the heart, that's not uncommon, but that's also not very deep meditation. So, you know, there are different aspects of your mental activity, one aspect being thoughts, especially verbal thoughts in the form of words. A second aspect is emotions. For most people, emotions aren't a major issue in meditation. But here, the third aspect of the mind is perception. Everything you see, hear, taste, smell, or touch occurs in your mind, right? So in deep meditation, the mind is completely resolved in samadhi. In samadhi, the mind is completely resolved, and there are absolutely no sight, sound, smells, taste, or touch, which means you are absolutely not aware of your breathing and heartbeat in a deep state of absorption. And of course, the same is true in deep sleep. You won't be aware of any thoughts, of any emotions, or of any sensations. Okay, the second question, which will introduce today's verses. If realization requires the effort of nididhyasana, that state cannot be eternal. I'll say that again, because he's correct. If realization requires the effort of nididhyasana, that state cannot be eternal, because what comes by effort will slip or vanish over time. His observation is correct, but he's made a wrong assumption. If realization requires the effort of nididhyasana, it doesn't. Enlightenment is the product of self-inquiry guided by the scriptures and teacher. That's when you discover your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Nididhyasana doesn't come into play at all in that process of self-discovery. You remember that I think in one of our introductory classes, we said that nididhyasana is not for the sake of enlightenment or realization, as he calls it. Nididhyasana is for the sake of removing habitual wrong thinking, which means enlightenment doesn't depend on it. You can discover your true nature and then continue to have all this habitual wrong thinking that continues to make you miserable. Then what's the point of enlightenment if you're still subject to all this, all these problems? So we can say then, nididhyasana. Let me use some, here's some very precise terms. Self-inquiry, guided by the teachings and guru, we call that shravana. The goal of shravana is atmajnanam, self-knowledge, discovery of your true nature, enlightenment, loosely speaking. But then you can have that atmajnanam and have a mind that's a mess. So therefore, nididhyasana treats those problems of the mind, whereas shravana is for the sake of atmajnanam, manana is for the sake of removing doubts. We're not going to talk about that further. Nididhyasana is for the sake of removing these habitual wrong patterns of thinking, or conversely, we could say it, it's for the sake of jnana pala. Now, I'm making a distinction here for the first time, a distinction between jnana and jnana pala. Pala means fruits, results. Jnana is the discovery. Jnana pala is when you abide in your true nature and feel yourself to be full and complete at all times, in all situations. That's jnana pala. Discovery is one thing. Abiding in what you've discovered is quite another. So the discovery is a result of shravana, and the ability to always abide in what you've discovered, that is the purpose of nididhyasana. So before continuing with our verses today, there's a favorite story that I always tell when the topic is nididhyasana. Some of you have heard this story, and bear with me, but this story to me is crucial to really show the purpose, the role, the function of nididhyasana. Many of you have heard my lion story. This is a favorite story of Swami Vivekananda, but I put my own spin on it, quite a different spin. It's a traditional story. Anyway, there was a lioness and her cub walking through the jungle. They got separated. The cub couldn't find its mother, and the cub was lost in the jungle, helpless and afraid, which is interesting because the lion is king of the jungle, but it's a little cub, you know, a little thing. Anyway, this cub happened to see a flock of sheep in a nearby clearing. And this cub went over, it was lonely and afraid, it went over and joined the flock of sheep. Normally, sheep are afraid of lions, but how can you be afraid of this cute little cub? So the sheep didn't run away, this cub stayed with the flock, and the cub grew up with the flock, which means the cub grew up thinking it was one of the sheep. It would graze in the grass, and maybe it learned how to baa, whatever the sound those sheep make. So anyway, this was the story of the cub. Now, the story continues that another lion, full-grown lion, was passing by and saw this really bizarre scene. There was a flock of sheep with a full-grown lion standing amongst them. Remember, this cub grew up with the sheep. So the sheep knew this particular lion to be friendly, So the sheep weren't afraid of this particular lion. In general, sheep will run away from a lion. Anyway, another lion passes by and sees this bizarre scene. A flock of sheep with a full-grown lion standing amongst them, and he wondered what the world is going on. The lion starts approaching, and of course all the sheep, lion, and they start running. And the confused lion runs along with the sheep, because you know all the sheep, along with the confused lion, they all know that lions eat sheep. Anyway, now the passerby lion is even more confused. Why is this lion running away from him? So he chases down that confused lion and traps him at the edge of a lake. And lions apparently don't like to swim, so he's at the shore of the lake, and this confused lion is petrified. "Please don't eat me, please don't eat me," he begs. The passerby lion says, "Why would I eat you?" And the confused lion says, "Because I'm a sheep, and lions eat sheep." The passerby lion says, "Yeah, I know lions eat sheep, but you're not a sheep. You're a lion like me. You're a lion like me. Tat tuam si." Right? It's a statement of truth. Tat tuam si. You are a lion like me. Of course, does a confused lion get it? "How can I be like you? I'm a sheep." So the lion says, "Here, I'll show you." And the lion makes the confused lion look at his reflection in the water. And then he asks, "The reflection, does it look like the sheep or does it look like me?" Very powerful. And we're not up to Nididhyasana yet, that comes in just a minute. But at this point, look at what we've just observed, that "you are a lion like me" didn't work. It was a mere statement of fact. There was a methodology involved to make the lion recognize its true nature as a lion, to make the confused lion see its true nature. So a statement of truth without the accompanying methodology doesn't work. Pretty clear, isn't it? When was the first time you read Tattvamasi? Were you enlightened? You get the point. So we require this teaching of Vedanta to get it, to understand the implications of those simple words, tat tvamasi. Before I continue, I have to share with you a beautiful, beautiful expression of my guru, Puja Swami Dayananda, who likened Vedanta to a word mirror. You look into the word mirror of Vedanta, and you see your true nature reflected in the words of Vedanta. Very beautifully expressed. The idea is that you have to see yourself, you have to discover your true nature, and merely being told isn't enough. You have to see, you have to discover. Notice, the confused lion has to see, meaning you have to see for yourself. No guru can make you enlightened. You have to see for yourself. Okay, now all of that is set up, by the way. Now comes the Nididhyasana part. It's an elaborate story, but it's really worth taking our time with this story. So the newly enlightened lion is ecstatic, because he realizes he's not this little frightened sheep. He's a king of the jungle. So the formerly confused lion thanks the other lion, and he goes boldly off into the jungle. And when night falls, he sleeps in the middle of the jungle, ignoring the flock of sheep over in the clearing. Why should he go to that flock of sheep? Morning comes, and this formerly confused lion wakes up. And I can only imagine that when you and I wake up, we're usually a little drowsy in the morning. So we can presume that this lion was a little drowsy when it woke up. And lions don't get a cup of tea or coffee in the morning, sorry. So this lion, waking up a little drowsy, sees the flock of sheep over in the clearing, and without thinking about anything in particular, it goes over and joins the flock of sheep. Why? He grew up with that flock of sheep. His whole life, almost his whole life, was with the flock of sheep. Now, look at this predicament. Can you say that the lion doesn't know he's a lion? You can't say that, right? If you were to tap the lion on the shoulder and says, "Hey, are you a sheep or a lion?" He would say, "I'm a lion." Then you could ask, "Well, why are you with this flock of sheep?" And if he was a typical American lion, I don't know what that means, he would say, "Am I still doing that? What am I doing?" Anyway, so you see the problem. The problem of habitual wrong thinking. In Sanskrit, viparita bhavana. Bhavana, a feeling which is viparita, which is opposed. Opposed to what you've already discovered. The habitual thinking is a huge problem, and it's nicely illustrated by this lion story. What is the solution? Suppose every morning when that lion is still a little drowsy, suppose he goes back to that lake and looks at his reflection again. Will he see anything new? No, he's already seen. But if he goes over to that lake every morning, it will slowly reduce his habitual wrong thinking. So finally, when he wakes up in the morning, he won't even think about the sheep. This is the process. To look at his reflection in the lake again and again is a metaphor for nididhyasana. To look at yourself in the word mirror of Vedanta again and again is a nice definition for nididhyasana. And you can see why I like this story so much. Very powerful, very clear, and that's what we're doing here in this chapter. We are looking into the word mirror of Vedanta again and again. Every verse, in fact, not every verse, almost every word is a mirror. Word by word, every word is part of that mirror. Every word reveals part, every word reveals some aspect of your true nature. And that's what we're seeing right now. So, anyway, lengthy story, but definitely worth the effort. So we'll continue. We saw verse 1 only in our prior class. We'll continue with verse 2, and you'll see how these verses function as a word mirror. And then we'll also discuss how these teachings are to be used for formal nididhyasana practice that you can do at home. Drishistu shuddho hama vikriyatmako. Drishistu shuddho hama vikriyatmako. Namesti kashchid vishayaswabhavatah. Namesti kashchid vishayaswabhavatah. Purasthirashchodvamadascha sarvatah. Purasthirashchodvamadascha sarvatah. Sampurna bhumatvajahatmani stitah. Sampurna Bhuma Twaja Atmani Stitaha. Remember, we have the longer meter here, having 12 syllables and a quarter. Drishihi tu Shuddha. That word drishi we saw in a prior verse. Drishi, literally seer, observer, the one who knows what's happening right now. In this ordinary experience, the one who knows what's happening in your mind right now, that one is a drishi. Drishihi tu, too, but that drishi, that consciousness, that awareness is shuddha. Now, shuddha, of course, means pure, but if we use the term pure consciousness, what exactly does that mean? Sometimes we use that word pure without really thinking. Pure water means what? Means only water, nothing else. So pure consciousness means what? Only consciousness. That's what it means. Don't think it's not dirty. I mean, you know, shuddha means pure. And the word amala and vimala, by the way, just a comment, silly comment about Sanskrit names. Vimala is a common woman's name. It literally means not dirty. Vimala without mala. Of course, we translate it as pure. Pure is the right translation, but the etymology is free from purity. And what I'm saying is the word shuddha does not mean free from purity. That's my point. Shuddha here means only. Shuddha, pure water means only water. And here, shuddha drishi means consciousness and consciousness alone, which is your true nature. And here, aham. Shankara's giving us his own personal example. This is Shankara's thoughts put into words for our benefit. Shankaracharya says, I am drishihi shuddha. I am nothing but consciousness. Consciousness that is avikriyatmakaha. Vikriya is change. Vikriyatmakaha, that which is subject to change. Avikriyatmakaha, that which is not subject to change. Unchanging consciousness. What was that we saw several years ago, that text of Totakacharya? What was that text of... it was of Totakacharya, Shruti Sara Samudharana. Was that? I think that's Totakacharya, right? Don't remember. I'm also not sure. I believe that text, we taught it here several years ago, Shruti Sara Samudharana. And the reason I'm bringing it up is that particular text was focused on this point, that your consciousness is avikriyatmakaha, it is unchanging. You, the witness of your mind's activities, are the unchanging witness of your mind's activities. If you weren't unchanging, if you changed along with the activities of your mind, you wouldn't be able to observe those activities, two things moving at the same speed, relative to each other, don't change. You remember I give this example every time. I'm sorry to repeat myself. But in order, if somebody is drinking coffee as he's driving to work, he's drinking coffee at 60 miles an hour. But if you're driving next to him, you don't see him drinking coffee at 60 miles an hour. He looks stationary. In order to see him drink coffee at 60 miles an hour, you have to be a stationary observer on the side of the road. Sorry, I keep using exactly that same metaphor, but it works. You know, it's very, very clear. So, in the same way, in order to accurately observe the changing conditions of your mind, you, the drishi, are necessarily an unchanging observer, avikriyatmakaha. He continues, Shankara says, na me asti kashchit, kashchit vishayaha, na kashchit vishayaha, no objects at all asti me, exist for me. Well, that's interesting. I translated, I possess no objects. Just a curiosity of the Sanskrit language. There's no verb in Sanskrit to have. In fact, Hindi, derived from Sanskrit, same thing, right? If you say, I have no money, what verb will you use? You can't say it. Mera dhan nahi. My Hindi is terrible, but you get the idea that there's no verb to have, to possess. Probably in most North Indian languages, because they're derived from Sanskrit, there's no verb to possess or have. And many people point out that's because Sanskrit is such a spiritual language. That sounds really cool, but I don't think so. All right. Sorry for being a little silly. Anyway, he says here, no, nothing at all exists for me, so bhavataha, due to my nature. And here we need to reflect on a fundamental teaching of Vedanta. And that is, your true nature as consciousness is more real than objects in the world. And the metaphor we use to understand it is the metaphor of the dream. The dreamer, the consciousness of the dreamer, is more real than objects in the dream. We're going to use this metaphor several times in today's class. In a dream, there are many things, but whatever things are present in a dream, they're less real than you, the dreamer. Remember our definition of real, that which doesn't come and go is real. The dream world comes and goes. All the dream objects come and go. The dreamer remains, the consciousness of the dreamer. Let me use it. That expression, the consciousness of the dreamer remains. The point I'm making here is dream objects are less real than the dreamer's consciousness. In this, just as pot is less real than clay, that kind of relationship. And here in this context, the world around you, it's not unreal, but it is less real than your consciousness. Now, there's a lot of Vedanta we've used to establish that. If I spend the rest of the class developing that, we will lose track of our nididhyasana. So I'm going to presume that you've heard this teaching before. If you haven't, I think in my introduction to Vedanta and other places, it's made clear. But I think the metaphor is pretty useful, and that is that you, the dream consciousness, are more real than your dreamed objects. Objects come and go. You continue to exist. Therefore, what is the just to point out the obvious. Can a dream lion hurt you? It can't hurt you. It's not as real as you, right? Only that which is real as you can affect you. This is a basic principle. Let me say it again. This is a really important principle. Only that which is as real as you are, can affect you. Dream objects can't affect you. They're not as real as you. Well, that metaphor goes on. Consciousness is more real than the world around us. The world around you, you say, but it can affect my body. Absolutely. It can affect my mind. Absolutely. It can't affect consciousness. Your body and mind are as real as the world around you. Your body, mind, and world are less real than consciousness. Notice I'm not saying illusion. I'm not saying unreal. The technical term, of course, is mithya, that which has a dependent reality. Not our topic today, but just to explain what Shankara is saying here, that nothing belongs to me. Nothing belongs to me, meaning he has no relationship with anything, no possession, because nothing out there in the world is as real as you. That's the sense here. Very profound teachings. He goes on verse after verse. By the way, Shankara's Nididhyasana here is much more profound. I made reference, in fact, I forgot to make reference did I make reference to that Ashtavakra Gita? Did I talk about that here? I did. I think I forgot to mention that Vasanti is teaching that Ashtavakra Gita in her reading class. So if you know a little Sanskrit, you can join her reading class and go through that Ashtavakra Gita. But the reason I wanted to point that out right here is this is 10 times more brilliant than that Ashtavakra Gita, honestly. I mean, Ashtavakra, it's a good text. It's a brilliant text. This is 10 times more brilliant, in my opinion. Anyway, you can make your own opinion, but that's what it looks like to me. Okay, continuing. Look at the last line. Sampurna Bhuma. Bhuma is an unusual word found in Upanishad to describe Brahman. Some of you know that Brahman comes from the root br, to expand. And here, bhuma. In fact, just saying the word makes you get that sense. Bhuma. That which is vast, that which is infinite, is bhuma. And here he puts a prefix, sampurna. Oh, supurna. Supurna. Purna bhuma. Completely infinite? You see the problem with language. We'll stay with vast. Bhuma, vast. Purna bhuma, completely vast. Supurna bhuma, really completely vast. So this is a word used to describe not just Brahman. Shankara here is using it to describe consciousness. Your consciousness. Sampurna bhuma. And we've had this discussion before. Your consciousness has no edge or boundary. It's not stuck inside your body. Instead of consciousness being inside your body, I said here, in fact, in our prior class, I think I said, your body is in consciousness, right? Just as space is in this room, but it's more correct to say that this room is in space. In the same way, we can say that consciousness is in your body, but it's more correct to say that your body exists in all-pervasive consciousness. That all-pervasive consciousness is Sampurna Bhuma. And you have to break apart the next. Oh, Sampurna Bhuma, in what way? It is absolutely, completely vast. How? Let's go up to the next line. Sarvataha, everywhere. Everywhere means Puraha, in front of you. Tiraha, to the side of you. Urdhvaha, Urdhvam, to the above you. and adaha, below you. So sarvataha, he's covered all directions in every way, in every direction. Sampurna bhuma, consciousness, pervades without boundary, without edge or limit. And he concludes here, breaking apart the words, tu, but it is ajaha, unborn, uncreated, and atmani stitaha, established in itself. Here, atma simply, well, in different ways of taking, atmani stitaha, established in itself, self-established, not dependent on anything else. So here, almost every word in this verse is like a little mirror. And we can use a single word, a properly chosen word, we can use it for the sake of nididhyasana. Let me give you an example. First line, avikriyatmaka. We'll take that word, unchanging, absolutely unchanging. Suppose we just use that one word. By the way, nididhyasana is often done with single words. Formal nididhyasana, the process I'm describing, usually works well with simple concepts, simple principles, and not with really complicated things. So you take something very precise, very, very distinct. So unchanging, avikriya, that which is unchanging. How would you perform formal nididhyasana on the unchanging nature of your consciousness? First step, of course, is to be clear. What are you going to contemplate on? You're going to contemplate here the nature of your consciousness, a consciousness present in your experience right now, but to recognize its nature as being unchanging. What will be that process? Remember from last class, we said the first step of nididhyasana, formal, and I keep making this distinction, there is such a thing as informal nididhyasana. Maybe we'll talk about that another time. So formal nididhyasana is when you sit down and meditate. And the first step, of course, is meditate. Perform some kind of dhyana meditation technique that makes your mind not just quiet, but I feel strongly it really only works if you can make your mind silent. That silence is crucial for this particular practice. Why? As I explained last week, in silence, the only thing that remains is you, consciousness. So a nice expression, in when your mind is silent, you rest in yourself. It's kind of a poetic expression, but it's meant to be suggestive. It's meant to give you an impression or a feeling. When your mind is silent, you rest in yourself as yourself. You are who you are, unencumbered, as I said last week, by anything else. That's step two. Step one is meditate. Step two, rest in yourself. That's your, what do they call it in science? Baseline. How's that? That's your baseline. Then introduce what you want to contemplate. And what are you going to contemplate? Avikriyatva, the state of Atma being free from change. So, after you've rested in yourself for a period of time, then you think. Then you have to start thinking again. You have to leave the silence behind and start thinking. What kind of thinking? Is my consciousness truly unchanging? You pose a question to yourself. Is my silence truly unchanging? Let me see. And I'm not being facetious. Let me see. And then you return to resting in yourself. Now, when you rest in yourself, you can't think. It's pure silence. But then after resting in yourself, then you come back to thinking and said, when, and then you can ask yourself this question, when I was resting in myself, did anything change? If something changed, you would have known it changed. But after you start thinking again, you recognize that when you rested in yourself in that moment of silence, nothing changed. This is an experiential confirmation of your nature as unchanging consciousness. So notice one word used as a mirror to see your true nature. You get, and I'll give another example. We'll give several examples so that you get the hang of it, so to speak, how this nididhyasana is performed. Let's see the next verse.
Ajo marashchaiva tatha jaro mrataha. Ajo marashchaiva tato jaro mrataha. Swayam prabha sarvagato hamadvayaha. Swayam prabha sarvagato hamadvayaha. Na karanam karyamativa nirmalaha. Na karanam karyamativa nirmalaha. Sadaiva triptaschatato vimuktahom. Sadaiva triptaschatato vimuktahom.
The first line, ajaha, unborn, amaraha, not subject to death, cha, eva, breaking the words apart, tata, in the same way, ajaraha, not subject to old age, decay, amritaha, not subject to death. That line is borrowed, so to speak, from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Now, is Shankara too lazy to make up his own verses? I'm being really, really silly here. You know, Shankara doesn't lack the skill to create his own verse. Then why does he paraphrase the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad here? He does it quite deliberately because whatever is taught in Upanishad is meant to be experientially confirmed through nididhyasana. That's his point. So we've said so many times, this isn't a matter of belief. So many times scriptures are understood, oh, I have to believe what this scripture says. Couldn't be further from the truth with regard to the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. These are statements of fact which have to be understood. So this first line, ajaha, unborn, etc., is not something you believe in. It's something to be understood. It's a statement of fact about your already existent true nature. Shankara includes it here so that you are encouraged to contemplate on these words from the Upanishad. So just studying the Upanishad is not enough. Shankara encourages us here to contemplate those teachings of the Upanishads. And just to, I should finish the idea here. Why is all of this a statement of fact? Well, we just discussed in a prior verse that Atma is avikriya, unchanging. If something is unchanging, can it get born? Birth is a change of condition. If something is unchanging, can it die? Death is a change of condition. If Atma is unchanging, can Atma grow old? That's the idea. So all of these are negated by the fact that Atma is unchanging. That becomes a subject matter for nididhyasana. Next word, swayam prabhaha. self-shining, self-evident, in order to see me, we require light. If this room were completely dark, you wouldn't be able to see me. I'm smiling. I just read a book on science, so I'm thinking radioactivity. If I were radioactive, I would glow in the dark. So if I weren't radioactive, I would not be self-revealing. If I were, what a bizarre example. If I were radioactive, I would glow in the dark. That's the sense here. Self-revealing, swayam prabaha, that which is a source of light. Do you need, if you want to see the sun, do you need a flashlight? That's the point. The sun is self-shining. It doesn't need to be revealed. Your consciousness is self-shining, doesn't need to be revealed. Also, that consciousness is sarvagataha, all-pervasive. We've already discussed that. And Shankara says, aham, I am. I mentioned, I think, before, that nididhyasana has to be in the first person. There's no such thing as second person or third person nididhyasana, because it has to be applied to you. I am sarvagataha. I am all-pervasive, boundaryless, limitless. Aham, I am that. And I am advayaha, non-dual. Non-dual doesn't mean... this is a little shift of perspective. Non-dual, one without a second. The best way to understand it, because we live in a world of duality, all of our experience, except for samadhi and deep sleep, all of our experience is in the realm of duality. So when we see this word advayaha, it goes against our experience, right? It does. We experience duality. So how can we bridge the gap between this statement, non-dual, and our experience, which is dual? And the answer is found in that dream metaphor. It's not that other things don't exist. It's rather that other things aren't as real as you. You are the one reality. Nothing else is as real as you. The classical example is you have a pile of 100 pots. There's only one clay. So that shows how the experience of duality doesn't deny the truth of non-duality. When you experience a pile of 100 pots, do you experience duality? Of course, there are 100 pots. But you know. Notice, you don't experience non-duality, you know non-duality. It's a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of appreciating there is but one clay because of which these 100 pots exist. So this shows the problem of experience. Experience functions in the world of duality. Have you ever read something like, you have to experience non-duality? People have that kind of thought. You need a non-dual experience. A non-dual experience is not an experience. The very word experience suggests duality. You have an experiencer and an experienced. The moment you use the word experience, non-duality goes out the door. So I'm being a little emphatic here because many deep thinkers about Advaita get stuck on this one. And they think that somehow you have to experience non-duality. And that is a huge blunder. It's a huge blunder because it misleads everyone into thinking, I need this special experience of non-duality. I haven't had this experience of non-duality yet, therefore I'm not enlightened. Yep. That's a common problem that advanced students of Advaita Vedanta encounter. So we have to get out of this experience thinking. You don't experience non-duality. You know that your consciousness is the substratum of all experience. One non-dual consciousness is that because of which all experience takes place. That's the correct understanding. Advayaha, and that word will come several times, so we saw the meaning here. He continues, Nakaranam karyam ativa nirmalaha. Nakaranam and nakaryam. Aham, I am not a karanam, I am not a cause. Aham na karyam, I am not an effect. I am not a cause, I am not an effect. Cause and effect are in the realm of duality. Realm of duality is a realm of experience. And we said, whatever you experience is not as real as consciousness, as in the dream example. So causality belongs to the world of duality. Consciousness transcends that world of duality. In fact, that's what he says in the next two words. Ativa nirmalaha. Nirmala, as we said before, like vimala, nirmala, without purity. And the context here is an ativa, extremely. Extremely free from impurity. How are we to understand that? Unaffected. Generally, we falsely believe that consciousness gets affected by whatever is happening around us in the world, by what's happening in our bodies, by what's happening in our minds. Absolutely not. How can it affect you if consciousness is unchanging? Watch this. Pain is in your knee. Pain is experienced in your mind. The pain in your mind is revealed by consciousness. How can that consciousness be affected by pain if that consciousness is unchanging? That's the key. Unchanging consciousness can't be affected by pain in your knee. Unchanging consciousness can't be affected by sadness in your mind. Unchanging consciousness can't be affected by anything. Ativa nirmalaha. And last line. Sada eva, always, triptaha, always full and complete. Tataha, therefore, vimuktaha, therefore, always liberated. Om. Does that sound familiar? Go back two verses. Verse 1, last line. Similar, not exactly, but it ends, Vimukta Om. It's a repetition. Usually in any text or scripture, repetition is a defect. In scripture,
Yeah.
In like even in speech, when you say the same thing over and over and over again, it's a defect of communication. If it's in a book, it's a defect of communication. And here in verse 3, Shankara repeats himself, it's not a defect here because he's not teaching us here. Remember, this is for the sake of contemplation. For the sake of contemplation, repetition is good. Remember, the lion has to look in the pond again and again and again. Repetition is a merit when it comes to Vedantic contemplation. Repetition is not a defect. Okay, to conclude our class today, let me give you one more example of formal nididhyasana. This time we'll use the word in the second line, Swayam Prabha. Swayam Prabha, self-shining, self-revealing. Okay? So how would we use that one word as a word mirror in contemplation to see your true nature reflected? Well, what are our steps of formal nididhyasana? Remind me if I forget to. We have to discuss informal nididhyasana in another class. So informal nididhyasana, sit down, perform some kind of meditation until your mind becomes silent. Step one. Step two, rest in yourself. And it's a deliberately poetic expression. It's meant to suggest an orientation you have at the time of meditation. Rest in yourself. Obviously, it means while your mind remains silent, you rest in yourself. And I guess what I mean by that is an appreciation of your true nature, because appreciation can't come with a silent mind. You can't appreciate anything. You can't do anything. When your mind is silent, nothing happens. You can't do anything. But then, after resting in yourself, start thinking again. That's when things get interesting. So then, in that mind, which is now thinking again, you introduce your theme for contemplation. What is the theme for contemplation? Swayam Prabha, self-shining, self-revealing. And so in contemplation, you might do it like this. How do I know that I am consciousness? How do I know that my consciousness reveals itself? Or simply put, how do I know that I am consciousness? And then rest in silence. After resting in silence, you think about it, and you then comes the appreciation afterwards. You appreciate the fact that in silence, consciousness continued without any effort on your part to make it known. There is no effort to reveal the presence of consciousness in that moment of silence. In that moment of silence, consciousness simply continued. I'm trying to make up a new metaphor. This is not the right time. So this is an example then of formal nididhyasana using that one word. How many words in each verse? Many. Each one of these, not every one of the words, but many of these words can be used as these individual mirrors, so to speak, individual words that you can contemplate on in the formal practice of nididhyasana. Okay, we're going quite slowly here at first. I think we're going to speed up pretty shortly because we're going to find lots of repetition. So repetition is a problem for teaching. Repetition is a merit for contemplation. So we may go more quickly through the remaining verses of this chapter. And we'll conclude today with our closing prayers.
Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Om Tat Sat.